This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring highlights of our week-long 30th anniversary retrospective, collecting interviews from our first couple of years. To start today's show, we have a 1988 interview with Ilya Kazan. He directed Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront, and directed East of Eden, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan had an equally important career in the theater. In the 1930s, he worked with the Group Theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the Method. He later co-founded the Actor Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1952, in the era when people accused of being communists lost their jobs. For many years, Kazan refused to publicly address the subject, but he broke the silence in his autobiography, Ilya Kazan, A Life. I spoke with him when it was published. We started with this classic scene from A Streetcar Named Desire.
Hey, shut up!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law on
you. Hey, shut up!
And then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're
I'll say haul you in and turn a fire hose on your
head. Get her down here.
You stinker.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it. And that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, untold numbers of people. What went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Many things with him, many times with him, he was ahead of me. That is, he understood what I said and understood it better than I said it. And I hardly had to tell him anything. Once I said, you fall on your knees, and he did. And that's all there was to it.
How many takes did you do of that scene?
How many takes did I do? I think 2.
And you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't mistake it, could you, really? That tone of voice, I mean, people have imitated it and shouted it and it's been on comedy shows and everything. It's just once in a decade a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough. And he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contract, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliated him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid. And I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it before you do.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly when he says taking dives, Palookaville, all that. And it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, but nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Gosh. Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation.
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them. The same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
Would you describe the meeting with James Dean that made you realize he had something?
I went to see a play of his, and a friend of mine named Paul Osborne had recommended him to me. And I went to see him in a play. He played a part of an Arab, a small part, and I didn't think much of him, but I thought, just to please Paul, I'd ask him to come into Warner Brother office. And I went in there that day, and there he was, like a, I say in the book, like a pile of rags in a corner, all bent over, scrunched up, and so on. I thought, well, he didn't even get up, didn't look at me, didn't get up. And so I went in the office and I thought, well, I'll make the son of a bitch wait a little bit, it'll do him good. So anyway, finally I called him into the office and he came in and he didn't say anything. He was not a talker. So finally he didn't say a damn thing. And I said, well, and he said, you want to go for a ride with me on my motorbike? So I said, God, I hate motorbikes. I didn't say it to him, but I do hate motorbikes. I think they're a menace. And I said, all right, Jimmy, well, let's go. So we went downstairs and he got his motorbike and unlatched it or unchained or whatever he did, and I got in the back, and he rode me around the middle of the city, and it was like he was showing that a country boy can defy the city and defy the rules of the city. He zigzagged in and out, I didn't want to ruin my relationship as a director by saying, Jimmy, I'm frightened, cut it out. I was frightened, but anyway, we finally both lived.
Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings in the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it, and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life. Mm-hmm. In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors are really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. You know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family, and my work. Those are the two things I have, and I thought, why should I give up my career for something I don't believe in? And if people who are communists are still going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that, then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like what was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who've never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry. I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Have you had second thoughts about the choice you made?
Not really, no. I think I wish they'd done it. I wish they'd named me. I think if the whole bunch of us had come out and said, we did have a communist cell, so what? I don't think they would have been worse off. I think it would have been clear the air. But, of course, except for the three I did talk to, they didn't do it.
Director Ilya Kazan recorded in 1988. He died in 2003 at the age of 94. After a break, we'll listen to my 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector of the 60s girl group The Ronettes. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring highlights of our week-long 30th anniversary retrospective, collecting interviews from our first couple of years. Up next, we have a 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector. In the early 60s, she was the lead singer of the Ronettes, perhaps the greatest girl group of the era, with records like Baby I Love You and Walking in the Rain. Their first big hit, Be My Baby, was later used in the opening scene of Martin Scorsese's film Mean Streets. A few years after Be My Baby rose to the top of the charts, Ronnie married her record producer, Phil Spector. At his insistence, she retired from the music business. After they divorced in the early 70s, Ronnie Spector started to record and perform again. She had a new album when I spoke with her. We started with this 1963 classic. Ronnie Spector, welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm glad to be here, Terry.
How did you first hear this song? Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. We met in a little studio, and they started writing around me. And I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that, the lyrics and stuff.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes. Just to do the lead part. And I remember being in the ladies' room at the New York airport, just singing in the bathroom, Be My, because I don't read music or anything, and I don't play any instruments. So it was like you had to just learn it over and over. And then Phil asked me to come to California and do it at Gold Star Studios. And that's where we recorded it. Just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
Now, as we'll hear, one of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this,
but you're
your famous what-uh-oh.
Yes.
Which you do a lot in Be My Baby and in a lot of your early records. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, Why do birds sing so gay? And love is a way with break of day. Why do they fall in love? And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little ho-ho's came out, you know. I think it was like I was 3 years old. I was singing this song. What was it called? I can't even remember. But it was like one of those yodeling songs for my family. And I think it's just something that I started, and it stuck. The ho-ho, ho-ho. As a matter of fact, when I did the Eddie Money song, Take Me Home Tonight, I did the uh-ohs without any music or anything. And then they added that to the track.
Can we talk about some of those old memories about
sure.
how you started to sing? You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin. Okay. Now, how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. And I remember being on the rooftop, you know, rehearsing and trying to get our routines together and stuff for the Brooklyn Fox. We had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out because our grandmother was very strict. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing, because out of boredom and out of all the people in our neighborhood were, like, becoming stars, like Frankie Lyman and stuff. And when I met him, I was in love with him. I didn't even know him, and I was in love with him. I was in love with his voice.
What kind of neighborhood was it that you grew up in?
I grew up in Spanish Harlem. Which was terrific because it was like every race, every color. every language. It was wonderful.
You broke in through into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right.
Singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either like dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, we tried to. You have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured. And so we wore our hair extra high, you know, the beehives in the 60s. And we wore eyeliner, you know, like Chinese eyes almost. And we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. So we really looked different. And what was the question? I forget. I get so excited.
Oh, about things you did to call attention to yourself when you're trying to break in.
See, when we first, we decided to dress up, and we had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us, and they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth, and we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike, and I was so glad because at 14 I was smoking, they just didn't know it, and it was great because we stood online, and we had to look older, so we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage. So it was very hard, but we had our gimmick. And it was amazing because before we even had Be My Baby as a hit record, being at the Brooklyn Fox's Murray the K's Dancing Girls, we would come out for lunch and it was actual girls dressed like us and our hairstyles. It was knocking me out. I couldn't believe it.
You had some of the highest hair in the whole music business.
Well, that's what I said. You had to have a little attention. And we certainly brought attention with those high hairdos. I mean, we must have worn our hair at least 10 inches high.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Were you, no?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, well, let me see one, because I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all. But we just did all the dances. You know, and by living in Spanish Harlem, you learned all the dances anyway. I mean, you could just look out the window and people were on the corner singing and stuff. And it was just how and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was Jambalina Kofi Spina Philly Gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet Mom Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy Handy Gale. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou. And I think that's when I got my ho, 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
Let's get to more of your recordings with the Ronettes. You first signed with a small label called Colpix Records.
And, that's right.
Those records never really became hits. How did you sign with Phil Spector, with whom you really recorded your best-known records?
Well, what we did, we were still with Colpix at the time when we met Phil. And he had my mother go down to Colpix Records and tell them that we didn't want any part of show business. We wanted to go back to school, and we just didn't want to sing anymore. And this was all Phil's plan, and my mother's and Phil's plan to get us on his label. So they released us, Colpix, and naturally we hadn't had any hits from them, so it wasn't like they were letting go these big stars. You know, we hadn't had any hit records, so it was perfect. And my mother went there one day, and she got them to release us because we were underage, and my mother said, they don't want to sing anymore. And about 6 months later, we had a number one record, so.
Fooled everybody.
Yeah. So that's how how we got to be with Phil on Philly's records. But that's not how we met him, you see. My sister and myself and my cousin got together one night, and we said, how are we going to meet this Phil Spector? We hear he's the best producer in the world. And my sister said, well, why don't we pretend we're dialing him. We knew the number to his office. We called his office one day, and we said, hi. We're calling for an audition. We're the Ronettes. Her name was Joni, Phil's secretary. She said, well, maybe, I don't know if Phil is auditioning, that I'll hold on. So we held on, and next thing we know, Phil was on the phone, and he said, I'd like to meet you girls the next night at Mirror Sound here in New York. And we couldn't believe it, and we did. And yeah, we sat down at the piano at Mirror Sound, and Phil said, sing me some songs that you guys just, you know off the radio. And of course, by my loving Frankie Lyman, I started singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love, ABCs of Love, and he immediately fell in love with my voice. And he said, that's the voice I've been looking for.
Once he started working with you, did he make suggestions to you and the Ronettes about changes he wanted to hear in either the harmonies or the lead vocals?
No, because first of all, the backgrounds weren't just my sister and my cousin. It was like We had about 10 people. There was Cher, there was Sonny, there was Darling Love. He had like 10, 20, and he would make those, double those voices. So it was, I don't know, it was very complicated in the studio, but it was, watching him work was a miracle to me, watching Phil Spector work in the studio.
You both became lovers. Did that add a certain drama to your performances when you worked together?
It may have, but I guess because I was, you know, performing so much before I met him, I just had that, I love performing, and I don't think he, by falling in love with him, made me any better as far as my singing. I just think he knew what materials to pick out for us, you know, song-wise, like Be My Baby, Walking in the Rain, and he was just a great producer.
Walking in the Rain, we've heard some of Be My Baby. Is Walking in the Rain one of your favorites of the records that you recorded?
Be My Baby is my number one. I love it forever. And Walking in the Rain, I love it too. Yes, I really do.
I love that too. Why don't we hear a few seconds of it, and then we'll talk some
okay.
more.
Okay.
Okay, this is the Ronettes.
I want him, and I need him, and someday, someway, whoa, 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 I'll meet him. He'll be kind of shy, and real good looking too, and I'll be certain he's my guy by the things he'll like to do. Like walking in the rain and wishing on the stars up above and being so in love. Oh, oh, oh.
Oh, Ronnie, that sounds great. That's Ronnie Spector singing along with a record from the
it.
1960s of Walking in the Rain.
I couldn't help it,
Terry. Oh, that's terrific. You gave up rock and roll for a while when you married Phil Spector.
That's not the right way to put it. I didn't give it up. As a matter of fact, I didn't know when I got married that I would never sing again. I thought, as a matter of fact, I would be recording a little bit more and maybe touring a little less. But I had no idea I would never record again or sing again or perform again. I sang again, but I didn't perform again.
So it was kind of against your will that you
started. Yeah, it was something I didn't expect.
Well, during that period, did you sing a lot in the house just to keep your voice in shape?
No, because there was no rock and roll allowed in my house then. It was only classical music played throughout the whole house, and how can I sing the classical music, you know, rock and roll? And I just didn't sing. I just... at night I would go to sleep, I remember, and just turn over and just think about being on stage and singing. Occasionally when I was in the bathroom or in the bathtub, I'd sing songs and stuff, but never too loud because he'd get angry.
Yeah, there was no rock and roll because your husband of the time, Phil Spector, didn't want it in the house. When you left that marriage and you left mm-hmm. him and you tried to re-enter the music business again, had you lost your bearings for a while? Was it hard for you to find your place? You'd been out of the scene for a while, mm-hmm. and you hadn't even been listening to the music for a while.
Right. No, but I never lost my bearing. It's like, I guess it's like riding a bicycle. Once you, you know, learn, once you fall off, you get right back on. And that's how I was with my singing. Of course, it was much tougher. I remember I came back in 74, and I went to Buddha Records. And they auditioned me. They loved me. And a few weeks later, Phil sent them a letter saying that I was still his wife because it took me 2 years to get a divorce. And immediately they let me go. So I had a lot against me because of Phil. You know, people just said, well, we don't want to be bothered with him because he was known for suing people and, you know, making scenes and keeping people in court. And that's basically why I didn't get started as fast as I wanted to, you know. Because everywhere I went, he sort of like, you know, stuck his two cents in at the time.
Well, I'm glad you're back recording and performing again. It's a pleasure to hear your voice
again. Thank you, Terry. I'm so glad to be back.
And I thank you very much for spending some time with us on Fresh Air.
Oh, anytime.
Ronnie Spector recorded in 1987. After a break, more from our 30th anniversary retrospective. We'll hear my 1989 interview with John Updike, recorded after he wrote his memoir, Self-Consciousness. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring highlights from our week-long 30th anniversary retrospective, collecting interviews from our first couple of years. I did many interviews with John Updike over the years, and I think my favorite is probably the one we're about to hear, recorded in 1989 after the publication of his memoir, Self-Consciousness, about all the things that made him self-conscious, including his stutter and the skin condition psoriasis. Updike, who died in 2009, was one of the most celebrated writers of his generation, best known for his series of novels about the character Rabbit Angstrom, his stories about the character Henry Beck, and his novel The Witches of Eastwick. He also wrote for The New Yorker. He won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and National Book Critics Circle Award, but he tried to keep a relatively low public profile and was reticent to reveal much about his personal life to his readers until he wrote his memoir. In the opening paragraph, he explained why he uncharacteristically chose himself as the subject of a book.
Shortly before the first of these personal essays was composed, but several years after the soft spring night in Shillington that it describes, I was told, perhaps in jest, of someone wanting to write my biography, to take my life, my load of ore and heap of memories, from me. The idea seemed so repulsive that I was stimulated to put down, always with some natural hesitation and distaste, these elements of an autobiography. They record what seems to me important about my own life, and try to treat this life, this massive datum which happens to be mine, as a specimen life, representative in its odd uniqueness of all the oddly unique lives in this world. A mode of impersonal egoism was my aim, an attempt to touch honestly upon the central veins with a scientific dispassion and curiosity.
Can you explain that fear of somebody taking your memories from you to write a biography?
Well, a writer's life isn't quite like a statesman's life, you know. It's what you write out of, and I just didn't want to be, and don't want to be intruded upon in that way. So as a defense against intrusion, I decided to invade my own privacy with these essays. At least I would know how to do it and would do it with good taste and delicately, and I'd know where to go. And if my life is of any intrinsic interest, and I'm not sure it is of much, I'm the one who's lived it, and the kind of things that I write about in this book are certainly things that a biographer would not fasten upon.
Well, the poetic device you seem to use is your body. The revelations in the central part of, you know, in the middle part of your memoirs come not from your career as a writer, but from your body, from physical ailments, from psoriasis, from a stutter, from asthma.
Yes, well, they what seemed to come to my attention of those moments of discomfort. And remember, the title of the book is Self-Consciousness, so I fastened upon those things which either made me self-conscious, like the psoriasis, or which showed self-consciousness, like the stuttering. And the religious aspect of it, again, has to do with the question of a self at all. Why do we seem to have selves that we prize greatly? Do computers, with almost as much circuitry now as human brains, do computers have selves? Are computers self-conscious? Is a wasp self-conscious? I think not. It's a kind of specifically human thing, which I was interested in exploring via my own poor little set of facts.
You first got psoriasis in kindergarten in 1938. Did people in the literary world know that you had a skin problem before you wrote about it?
I don't know. I suppose some did. I wrote a kind of amusing, I've always thought, short story called Journal of a Leper, or From the Journal of a Leper, which is about psoriasis, and which is much quoted in medical texts of a certain kind. Psoriasis is rather rarely written about. We're all shy about it, those of us who have it, and wish we didn't and don't want to talk about it much. So it took a long time for me to confess to it. I feel it's some, you know, it's a sin of some kind. It's a dermal sin, and it took me a long time to believe that it wasn't really my fault, and I could talk about it more or less freely. No, I don't think it was commonly known. I'm told it doesn't really much show, and the discomfort has mostly been self-produced rather than other people produced.
Well, were you worried about calling attention to it, though?
No, not really. A writer is somebody who tries to tell the truth, right? And your value to your society is a certain willingness to risk being honest. And so to be honest about this was part of the general job as I see it.
Well, I think you found a lot of universals in the particulars of your experience with psoriasis. And I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on psoriasis. And my guest is John Updike, and this is a reading from his new book, Self-Consciousness.
Psoriasis keeps you thinking. Strategies of concealment ramify, and self-examination is endless. You're forced to the mirror again and again. Psoriasis compels narcissism. If we can suppose a narcissus who did not like what he saw, in certain lights, your face looks passable. In slightly different other lights, not. Shaving mirrors and rearview mirrors in automobiles are merciless, whereas the smoky mirrors in airplane bathrooms are especially flattering and soothing. One's face looks as tawny as a movie star's. Flying back from the Caribbean, I used to admire my improved looks. Years went by before I noticed that I looked equally good in the lavatory glow on the flight down. I cannot pass a reflecting surface on the street without glancing in hopes that I have somehow changed. Nature and the self, the great moieties of earthly existence, are each cloven in two by a fascinated ambivalence. One hates one's abnormal, erupting skin, but is led into a brooding, solicitous attention toward it. One hates the nature that has imposed this affliction, but only this same nature can be appealed to for erasure, for cure. Only nature can forgive psoriasis. The sufferer, in his self-contempt, does not grant to other people this power.
There's a sentence in there that I think probably a lot of people will really see themselves in, and that is, I cannot pass reflecting surface on the street without glancing in the hopes that I have somehow changed. I really think you put your finger on something there.
Well, I'm happy to hear it, because I've always thought that nobody except me was annoyed with the way they looked or self-conscious to this degree, but I guess we all are. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to be born into a certain body instead of an ideal body, and all of our faces, the whole idea of a face is slightly funny, isn't it? If you can put yourself outside of the species a moment, these faces we carry around with the holes in them and the shining holes and the dark holes and then the one that shows a lot of teeth, it's all odd beyond belief, really.
Yeah, well, you feel like, well, it's my face, but my face isn't my fault.
Right. It's not your fault, but it is what you're stuck with.
Well, you seem to think that it's some of your weaknesses that have made you what you are, some of your defects, like psoriasis. You think that you became the person who you are and the writer who you are because of it.
Well, I think it forced my attention away from any very public career, like being an actor or a school teacher, which is a kind of actor, and what my father did, and was that was the profession that society had more or less laid out for me. And I think my determination to avoid teaching is in part a shyness of any kind of public performance daily, putting yourself there, trying to look good. So I've been extra serious about making it as a freelance writer, where I don't really have to come out of the closet, where I can do the whole thing at a distance and in a room by myself via the mails. So yes, in that extent. Also, psoriasis has made me be a little bolder than I might have ordinarily been, and it certainly got me to the Caribbean. I've seen a lot of lovely islands that I wouldn't have seen if I didn't have psoriasis.
You said it made you bolder. You write, only psoriasis could have taken a very average little boy, a boy who loved the average, the daily, the safely hidden, and turned him into an adaptable, ruthless enough writer. Where does the ruthlessness come in?
Well, I think telling the truth is kind of a ruthless act, both in specifics, since you do invade some privacies in fiction, and in the larger way, you are trying to, or I am trying to, as it were, rub humanity's face in the facts of our existence, that there is much that is ignoble and desperate about being a human being, and my fiction is in part motivated by pointing these things out. So yes, there's something ruthless and cruel. Even to generate suspense is a bit of a tease, isn't it? So there's a kind of a sadistic element in the writer's attempt to keep the reader's interest.
At the end of your chapter about your skin, it's pretty well cleared up because of some experimental treatments you were getting. Did you have any problems after writing about this? You know, a lot of people believe that psoriasis has a component of psychology behind it?
It has a psychosomatic component.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So I was wondering if really thinking about it a lot and writing about it made you any more symptomatic.
I didn't have a flare. We call that a flare in the trade when your psoriasis suddenly goes bad again. And I do say in the piece that it rather resists all these treatments, that when I was young, a few days in the sun would do marvels. And the older I got, the longer it took. In a way, the tougher the skin and the psoriasis became. And so would the artificial light treatment, which for 10 years gave me 10 years of feeling pretty good about myself and my skin. Now I'm on a pill. Which also has done a pretty good job. So I'm not at a very dermally stressed moment in my life, and I wasn't aware of... In a way, it's a relief to have it all out there, and I put it out not to say poor old me, but lucky me. Lucky me that I had this affliction, which made me be a little original and which forced me, as it were, into the artist's isolation, which gave me the courage to try to be an artist.
You also devote a chapter in the memoir to the stutter that you had. And you say in it that, you know, with the stutter and the psoriasis, when people wouldn't acknowledge it, when they wouldn't mention it to you, you'd wonder, is this invisible to other people?
Well, you don't know how bad you look or sound to other people, and there's always the hope that, in fact, you look and sound fine. I have rarely... The stutter comes and goes, and when it does come, is embarrassing to me. My wife tells me it's charming, but I've never found other stuttering people especially charming, so I kind of take that with a grain of salt. But yes, I guess there is the hope that if at least it might be noticed but not written about, and it was this article written by a reporter for the Jerusalem Post that came right out and talked about my stutter. I was uneasy in that situation. I think I was tired from jet lag, and I didn't quite, I was cast into a role where I felt uneasy, and as I say in the piece, I think that's when I begin to stutter, is when I feel somehow mistaken or uneasy in the role I'm performing.
You say something that I think, again, a lot of us will have experienced, that when you take something that's supposed to be unconscious, like the act of speaking, you know, moving your tongue around to form vowels, and it suddenly becomes a conscious act, you lose yourself, you lose it. It's like when you think about walking with grace, you walk really stiffly. When you think about breathing, you become really conscious of every breath that you take, and it becomes a belabored act instead of an unconscious one.
It's quite true. And speaking, you think of the number of muscular motions that your tongue is making just to form the sentence you so gracefully uttered. It's amazing it works as well as it does.
You know, the last time we did an interview on Fresh Air, we talked a little bit about why you dislike being interviewed and about how you distrust the kind of public self that writers are sometimes forced to cultivate. In reading your memoir, I of course started to think that other reasons had to do with perhaps fear of stuttering, with fear that skin would be broken out.
Yes, both.
Okay.
Both are true, and it was a great relief when I first began to go on television. Years ago, I was delighted to find that you got a coat of makeup, and I always felt immensely happier once I was made up, and I would wear it all day long until it wore off. So that, yes, on the other hand, having that anxiety about how you look or whether you're going to stutter or not relieves you of other anxieties, and the truth seems to be that I'm a fairly garrulous performer once I'm launched in that direction.
There's one last reading that I want to get in. And this is from a section toward the end of your memoir. It's in part about the fears that one experiences at night and you writing about them during the day.
Yeah, and it's about writing as a release, isn't it? As a kind of self-therapy. I do think that writers who have any kind of social sanction for their activity are one up, because when you write about something in a strange way, you become lightened of it. Let me read this paragraph. So, writing is my sole remaining vice. It is an addiction, an illusory release, a presumptuous taming of reality, a way of expressing lightly the unbearable. That we age and leave behind this litter of dead, unrecoverable selves is both unbearable and the commonest thing in the world. It happens to everybody. In the morning light, one can write breezily, without the slightest acceleration of one's pulse, about what one cannot contemplate in the dark without turning in panic to God. In the dark, one truly feels that immense sliding, that turning of the vast earth into darkness and eternal cold, taking with it all the furniture and scenery and the bright distractions and warm touches of our lives. Even the barest earthly facts are unbearably heavy, weighted as they are with our personal death. Writing, in making the world light, in codifying, distorting, prettifying, verbalizing it, approaches blasphemy.
Do you feel ever that it's your demons that keep you writing? Even though you'd like to talk of yourself about writing, about average things, about the little corners, about the domestic news.
I think there's something demonic in the complete writer. Yes, I think that an ideally nice person would probably not become a writer. I try to write pleasantly, fairly more than pleasantly. I feel there is much in life that is frightening and unpleasant, and that we are, among other things, cruel beings. All of the shadow side of one's self-knowledge, of course, goes into writing, and in a way energizes it. It gives you the energy to undertake this fantastic activity every morning.
John Updike recorded after the publication of his memoir, Self-Consciousness, in 1989. Updike died 20 years later at the age of 76. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.